SU Thursday Night Talk is coming right up. This week, Jana Valakovic is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. Please give us a call at 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, at 1-800-640-5911, and to our operating text line at 492-KHSU. Now over to Jana.
Good evening. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. My name is Jana Valakovic, and for my day job, I work for the University of California in the Cooperative Extension Program in the Eureka office. And for the shows that I host, my goals are to talk about agriculture, forestry, and natural resource management. And for tonight's show, I set up a conversation about climate change and the effects on marine ecosystems. What does a changing climate mean for North Coast fishermen and shellfish producers? Now, that's a pretty complicated topic, and so I thought I'd start with a little bit of introduction to this subject. And so tonight, what we're really going to be talking about is the carbon cycle. And while many of us have heard about how the increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, I'm guessing that many of our listeners may be less familiar with the interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean. And so by way of background, as the atmosphere becomes more saturated in carbon dioxide, the world's oceans are capable of absorbing some of that carbon dioxide. About a quarter of what we release into the atmosphere every year can be absorbed by the ocean. So this means that as the atmospheric carbon dioxide levels increase, so do the levels in the ocean. Now, some scientists thought this might be a benefit of the ocean removing this greenhouse gas from the atmosphere. However, after decades of ocean observations, we now see that there's a downside. The carbon dioxide that is absorbed by the ocean is changing the chemistry of the seawater, and specifically the pH. And this is a process called ocean acidification. And over the last 150 years, the surface ocean pH is estimated to have decreased from approximately 8.25 to about 8.15, so moving from being more basic to more acidic. And this represents an increase of about 35% of hydrogen ion concentration in the world's ocean. So while that seems like a small change, it can have profound effects. Additional changes are seen in ocean temperatures. Some of our listeners may remember the warm blob, or the 5-degree increase in Fahrenheit of the Pacific Ocean that persisted from about 2013 to 2016. And that blob was about 3.5 million square miles that stretched from Mexico to Alaska and unfortunately was linked to several mass die-offs in marine animals and seabirds that were thought to be related to changes in food availability. And it's probably also having an effect on our ocean conditions and the salmon populations that we are to see this year. So a lot of complex topics. And so to help unpack these global issues and explore what these changes might mean for the North Coast, I have three very talented guests tonight to join us in this conversation. So in the studio, I have Eric Bjorksted, who's a research fisheries biologist and an oceanographer with the Southwest Fisheries Science Center, part of NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service. He works out of the Trinidad Marine Laboratory and has an adjunct appointment with Humboldt State. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks.
I also have Joe Tiberzi. He's a marine ecologist with the University of California's Sea Grant Program. He, too, has an office in Eureka and has an adjunct appointment at Humboldt. So, plug in Humboldt State. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
And I have Greg Dale, who's an aquaculturalist with Coast Seafoods, also based out of Eureka, and has extensive experience working in Humboldt Bay. And he has a lot of community experience. He's both on the boards of the Harbor Commission and the Humboldt County Farm Bureau. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you.
So, thank you for joining me and exploring this topic. I got interested in it from a trip I took on the Mattakit a couple of years ago, and we were talking about aquaculture and the relationships between the marine environment and Humboldt Bay and what we produce here. And as I started to tease that apart, I realized we could have a lot of fun thinking about that in a radio environment. So can each of you give me a bit more introduction about what you do and kind of what brings you to this show? And maybe, Eric, I'll start with you.
Sure. When people ask me what I am, I say fisheries oceanographer. I look at the interaction between physical drivers of the ocean, what makes the currents go, what causes nutrient fluxes, and how that affects the populations and ecosystems of the California current. And there's a lot of different ways that that goes, whether it's thinking about MPAs or managed resources. One of the key things I do up here on the North Coast is conduct an ocean observing program where we go out monthly, sample what the plankton look like, what the temperature and salinity structure of the ocean is off Trinidad Head as part of a coastwide effort to understand what's going on in the California Current, how it's responding to changes in atmospheric forcing in the winds and other processes.
Excellent. How about you, Greg?
I'm a simple shellfish farmer, not near as bright as either one of these two guys, but we use a lot of the information that these guys collect, and it affects all of the issues that happen in the ocean affect us, because our shellfish start out at a very small size, and it takes a lot of energy for them. It takes a lot of their energy budget to grow when they're small, especially when they have issues like ocean chemistry and ocean acidification.
And you, Joe?
Yeah, I am a marine ecologist, and with California Sea Grant, and I have a really great scientific job that allows me to sort of live in this community, identify natural resource and environmental issues, and then find funding and resources and partners to work on them. And something I'm really excited about is a new project that'll look at ocean acidification and the extent to which eelgrass within the bay may actually buffer, because eelgrass, being a green plant, takes up carbon dioxide. So it to some degree, may actually buffer and protect the bay from ocean acidification and make it more hospitable place, especially for the youngest and smallest oyster, the larvae. And there's a new hatchery that is currently being built, and I think Greg's company is in the process of permitting getting a new, potentially another new hatchery here. But one of the things this project will also do is create establish a really high resolution, real-time carbonate chemistry instrument, similar to those at other hatcheries, that'll benefit the new hatchery that's currently being built, and any other hatcheries that may come along will benefit from having that really real-time, very accurate data about the chemistry of the bay.
All right. Great. So we've got two scientists and someone who uses that science and applies it. So let's start at the global level. You know, what are the issues with a change in ocean chemistry? What do we know? What don't we know? And why does that matter?
Do you want to take that?
Sure.
Okay, I'll start. Well, the big thing is what you talked about in the introduction, is that the ocean has absorbed some 25% to 30% of the human added carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, has gone into the ocean, has increased the acidity of the ocean, has reduced the ability of shell-forming organisms to precipitate calcium carbonate and make their shells. And that's a global process. It's more intense in the northern or the polar cold waters. And we're beginning to get at what the real implications of that are for ecosystems in terms of how are shell-forming organisms being affected, how are different kinds of algae being affected, and what are the consequences in food chains. For instance, there's a recent paper out showing that Dungeness crab populations may be adversely affected by increasing acidification, not necessarily because the crabs themselves have trouble making their shells, but because their prey are being adversely affected by the increased acidity in the ocean. So those are the kind of things that that we're beginning to think about. There are other consequences of global warming that we can talk about on a nutrient supply, et cetera. Maybe later in the program, that have more to do with the physical forcing. But as far as chemistry, that's my understanding.
I'll say that, right now we're borderline in the beginning of identifying the issue, and it's been going on a long time, and we're really coming to grips with understanding, the science behind it. But it's going to get worse. It's going to, we're continuing to put carbon in the atmosphere, and I think that's what we as, users of the ocean, we need to recognize that it's not going to be the same. And I think there's a lot of science out there to acquire the data to show and make these correlations between what's happening in the ocean and and what's happening to the food chain, to, you know, in our case, shellfish, crab larvae, feed. It really can be quite scary, mm-hmm. if you start thinking about it like that.
And I might just add that ocean acidification, in contrast to climate change, doesn't rely on any physical forcing models. It's really simple chemistry, that if you take water and you bubble carbon dioxide and dissolve more carbon dioxide in it, it does decrease the pH and makes the water more acidic. So even a person who doesn't accept the science behind climate change, the ocean acidification impact on its own is a really good reason why we should think about dialing back our carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. And two, it's really timely and important because the water we're seeing that's low pH and acidified is water that last equilibrated with the atmosphere over in the Western Pacific off of Asia 30 to 50 years ago. So that means that anything we do to reduce carbon emissions might start having a benefit, but only in 30 to 50 years. But conversely, if we keep, you know, making things worse, then we're sort of dooming people even 30 to 50 years in the future to things continually growing worse. So, mm-hmm. so we really, you know, it's a slow moving, inexorable train. And, you know, at some level we're sort of in the hole with a credit card, and we can keep deficit spending, or we can start, you know, paying back the principal a little bit at a time. And we definitely need to move as fast as we can towards, you know, stopping overspending and starting to pay things back.
So is it fair to assume that the effects are uneven across the ocean? They're probably more pronounced in certain places and less pronounced in other places. Do you know how our west coast of the Pacific, what the chemistry looks like here?
Well, we're in an interesting place because we have the upwelling system off our coast. So rather than, say, a more consistently stratified tropical ocean or even off the east coast, we are getting that deep water up against the coast whenever we have strong upwelling. And that deep water has carbon dioxide that it's absorbed from the atmosphere a long time ago, as Joe has mentioned, as well as having been enriched in carbon from the things that have died and sunk into mm-hmm. the deep water. So we see hot spots up along the coast. In fact, we are just next to one, a hot spot for exposure to low pH water during intense upwelling. Happens right here in the vicinity of Cape Mendocino. There are a couple others up and down the coast. What's nice about that is we can actually see what do conditions, you know, 100 years down the road, we can, you know, 100 years down the road, say for up off British Columbia or other places along the California coast, we can see them here and ask how do the ecosystems vary and begin to make predictions. But as Joe said, we are getting source water that has been enriched in carbon dioxide. There are other processes that enhance that enrichment as well. And we're beginning to see increasing and stronger, and we expect to see that, you know, increasing and stronger exposures to ocean acidification. We expect that to ramp up in the future.
So just to make sure I got that correct, so you're saying that we're seeing more pronounced acidification locally here than in other Pacific Coast communities?
Yes, and let me backtrack.
And so that's like a foreshadowing of what it may be like in other locations.
Yes, but that is also, it's a natural phenomenon.
Right.
There's always, as you go deeper into the ocean, there's less oxygen, there's more carbon dioxide just from things dying and decaying. And that deep water comes up against the coast during coastal upwelling. What we're seeing is that source water is getting more acidic, and spatially along the coast, there are places where upwelling is really intense, narrow shelf, so we get to see it really intensely here relative to places up off Oregon.
But then we've been adapted to that for a long time because of that natural shelf and upwelling.
Exactly.
Right.
But what we have then is natural experiments, so that we can go up and down the coast and see a gradient and say, well, what does this community look like here? What does it look like to the south, to the north? there are scientists here at HSU that are engaged in that kind of comparative research.
Right, right. So it's not like we're seeing pronounced change here. It's more that we have just one extreme side of that that may be what other locations are likely to see down the line.
Yes.
Upwelling's good, though. I mean, upwelling is not a bad thing. It's what drives all the productivity around here because it brings nutrient-rich water up from the deep. The problem with it is we have it. It's really hard on shell-forming organisms because of the pH, and it's really more than pH, and maybe these guys will get into that. You don't want me to explain aragonite saturation, but the problem with it is what Joe said is you're the more we see this older water, you know, as the water, as we move forward in the future, we're going to see higher and higher pHs and lower we're going to see lower pHs,
yes,
and higher need for, God, how am I going to say this?
Mitigation, right. Things,
mitigation,
water treatment.
Yeah, management.
Yeah.
It's just coming, and it's...
Right. So those times, they are a-changing.
They are, yeah.
Now, what about the water temperature issue? What are the effects of a changing ocean temperature?
I'll take this one again, and then
sure.
You guys can chime in. One of the big changes is the warmer water is, the lighter it is, the less dense, the more it will float to the surface, okay? Heat rises. When we see heat being transferred into the ocean surface, it makes it harder for the wind to mix that lighter water into the deep water, cold water below it. And so for a given amount of wind, you get less mixing, you get less nutrients coming up, you get less oxygen pushed down into deep water. And so that's one of the things that's kind of exacerbating not only this atmospheric enrichment of the ocean's CO2, but the fact that that CO2 is being trapped down low in the water column. Nutrients are not coming up to supply phytoplankton growth and things like that. And this is happening out in the open ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Reduced wind mixing was a major contribution of generating the blob. We didn't get the winds in the right place at the right time, so the cold water didn't get mixed up. It's all kind of a...
And it feeds on itself, too.
And so when we get this kind of what we call reduced ventilation or this capping of the open ocean, it changes the quality of the source water for upwelling. It's higher in CO2, lower in pH, higher in nutrients because those nutrients have not been pulled up. But then we get into that trade-off. Are a lot of nutrients enough to offset... A lot of nutrients in the production they supply enough to offset the energy requirements needed to lay down shell in an inhospitable or a less hospitable environment? And those are open scientific questions right now. If you have enough upwelling, is that enough to allow an oyster to lay down enough shell to take, you know, to counter the effects of lower pH? Where's that balance?
Things,
we don't know.
It's almost like when you make rock candy and you super saturate sugar in the water. And at some point, it just takes a little crystal to make it all crystallize, right? It's the same thing with really low pH. It makes the animal have a hard time accumulating aragonite, which is the first form of shell,
carbonate.
Sorry.
Got it.
And so it takes more of their energy budget to accumulate that shell out of the water, and they starve it. They basically starve to death without making a shell.
Well, and that shell's about protection. It's about
filtering.
It's about a home. It's about all of their structure, right?
And it does. It's not just oysters. Mm-hmm. It's the whole food chain,
right?
And I'll add to what Eric was saying. I think that one of the scary things that we all see with warming ocean conditions that we've seen this last, you know, 3 or 4 years, the ocean is goofy. You see a whole different the species that utilize that warmer water are different than what we normally see. You know, we've had mola mola, we've had squid, the whole squid fleet here the last couple of years. Harmful algal blooms, we've had domoic acid, the crab fleet's been suffering with that. Just those sorts of things are more prevalent in a warmer ocean than they are in a colder ocean. And that's, I think, one of the repercussions of what we see in the last 3 or 4 years, especially from the blob.
Right, right. So This is Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, your host. We're talking about climate change and the effects on marine ecosystems. My guests are Greg Dale from Coast Seafoods, Joe Tiberzi from California Sea Grant, and Eric Bjorkstead from the National Marine Fisheries Service. We welcome your calls at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911, or give us a text at 707-492-KHSU. So let's bring it back to the bay. So what makes Humboldt Bay so well-suited for shellfish production?
Well,
or is it?
It is. I mean, we're really fortunate to have the water quality that we have here, but it's more than that. The upwelling that we were talking about it produces a lot of primary production. So oysters feed primarily on algae. Algae is the basis of the whole food chain. You know, algae is eaten by little bugs, which are eaten by bigger bugs, which are eaten by bigger bugs, and eventually by fish or shrimp, and then, you know, on up the food chain. Humboldt Bay is kind of a really unique spot. We don't have a huge watershed in Humboldt Bay, so it's not a true estuary, although it has some estuarine parts, but it's not like a San Francisco Bay or a Willapa Bay in the fact that it doesn't have this huge watershed that drains a bunch of fresh water into it. So it's very productive. We have a community that is very in tune to water quality, so we're very fortunate to have, you know, some of the better water quality on the West Coast, and some of the better production rates, and we're kind of right in the middle. It's not too cold. As you go north to Alaska, it gets colder. As you go south to Mexico, it gets warmer. You get diseases in the warmer waters. You get slow growth in the colder water. So we benefit from the Goldilocks syndrome.
All right. You know, I never really thought about how we differed from the Willapa Bay or some of those other bays, but you're right. We don't have a major river system coming in. We've got a bunch of smaller tributaries that contribute. Yeah.
Well, and Greg, there's also the high health program that means that the seed and eventually larvae that are produced here can kind of go pretty much anywhere because we don't have any of the major oyster pathogens that have to be sort of that may restrict where larvae and seed that are produced elsewhere can go.
True. Yeah. No. What we have is we have a really long history of what we do have, what diseases and organisms that we do have, pathogens that we do have, versus other areas that may or may not have the pathogens, but don't have the record. So we don't have any real, I mean, the coast is all interconnected, so everybody has, you know, you've got Haplospiridians is a common parasite in Pacific oysters. We have those in Humboldt Bay very, very rarely. We know that they have them here, but we don't have a high incident level of them. So it really doesn't affect where our oysters can go, whereas they don't have that long-term history in other bays around the West Coast, and they have other issues. You know, they've got herpes in Tomales Bay, they've got withering foot and some of those diseases for other species like abalone in Southern California, so they're not able to ship out of those bays.
Mm. Well, then, so what shellfish do we grow here?
We grow clams, Manila clams. We grow Pacific oysters, and we grow Kumamoto oysters. Those are pretty much the three species that that all the shellfish growers here grow.
Greg, going back to the sort of high health plan, do you see a benefit to if Hog Island's working on getting a hatchery here? Mm-hmm. It sounds like Coast is considering a hatchery. If those two hatcheries happen and there's enough larvae produced to sort of supply all the local seed production, would that be advantageous to have sort of close the loop within the bay so that the seed and larvae that are used here are all produced locally as well? Would that make us even more protected from bringing in a pathogen, or is that?
Certainly, I think most of the larvae has come out of three or four different hatcheries in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And so any pathway into the bay that could possibly have happened in the last you know, 50, 60 years, it's probably happened already. But yeah, no, I think closing the loop and using only seed produced in California is certainly a plus. Or only produced in Humboldt Bay, because I don't think there's any place else that you would be allowed to produce seed in California and ship, other than Humboldt Bay.
And so are we known for a particular, like the Kumos, are we renowned in some way, or are we just kind of in run-of-the-mill producers? I mean, I like to think delicious. I have a little hometown proud. I think our Kumos are delicious. But
thank you. Thank you. I thought you were going there wrong.
Yeah, but
no, we do have a pretty good reputation. I mean, some of the California in general. So you've got some really, really good oysters that come out of California. It doesn't matter if they come out of Morro Bay or Tuolumne Bay or Humboldt Bay. They're all really high quality product, mostly because of the way we've always grown them here. We've grown them here for the last 30 years. And they're grown as singles. The single Ted Kuiper and Hog Island, pretty much, I would say they invented, but they brought the single oyster seed market to California. And they really capitalized on that in the last 30 years, and they produce a very high quality individual oyster that's not a commodity type oyster like the oysters that we used to produce here in Dredge. So we produce a lot of those small. The Kumos are individually are really high quality animal, but even a Pacific grown as a single is a nice animal to eat.
I guess I'm getting at, you know, is there, we've got a lot of Humboldt brand identity around other crops and other products. So is there something that we can hang our hat on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pretty much anywhere you go and eat a Kumo in a restaurant, doesn't matter where in the world, it's more than likely coming from Humboldt Bay. And what's interesting is it very well may be served with Cypress Grove cheese, or, you know, frequently we see these niche markets, you know, the vegetables that come out of Shively are along with it. You know, some of these really high-end crops that we have here, not necessarily the crop that you were
insinuating. No, I mean, we've got the Humboldt brand that's...
But yeah, no, we have actually quite a few, and you know more about this than I do. We have quite a few really high quality products that come out of Humboldt Bay.
And so, do we produce more Kumos?
We produce probably 85% of the Kumos in the country come from Humboldt Bay.
Wow.
And one of the things, Kumos are kind of a.
They're the smaller ones, right?
They're smaller. They're slower growing. They have a delicate flavor. They have a smaller digestive gland than a Pacific oyster. But the beauty of a Kumo is they're really hard to grow. They don't have good fecundity. They don't have good survival. All the issues with a Kumo that causes them to be a problem to grow in other bays, we don't have here. So it's another Goldilocks thing where we're just right.
We're just right.
Yeah.
So they're happy here.
They are happy here.
Okay.
Happy oysters.
Happy oysters. Excellent. So how do those larger scale ocean conditions affect Humboldt Bay?
Do they? They do. So we haven't had a hatchery here, and really the fine scale acidification issues are very, very detrimental to small post-fertilization larvae. And it doesn't matter whether it's oyster larvae or crab larvae or any kind of shell-forming organism, and that first 5 or 6, 10, 20 cell divisions are starting to build their valve or their shell. And they have a certain amount of food in them, just like a chicken egg, okay? They have enough storage of food in that egg to provide them with energy until they can start making their own, you know, their own energy. And what happens here, we don't do any of that. We don't spawn oysters. Now, Hog Island will be spawning oysters here in the very near future. But the hatchery industry tends to want these mechanical or these measuring devices, and they're the one that we all have right now is called a Burkulator. Joe's gonna build a better one. Well, they're gonna a better Burkulator. It's the newfangled one are easier to maintain, is what I understand.
No, I think Burke Hales, the oceanographer from Oregon State, I think he's just going to build us the old-fashioned, tried and true, and very involved to maintain.
Okay. Yeah. So, and what is this Burkeolator?
It's this state-of-the-art real-time carbonate chemistry instrument.
Okay.
Affectionately nicknamed Burkeolator for Burke Hales, who's a oceanographer at Oregon State.
Okay. So we're going to instrument the bay and be able to get a better signature of how chemistry is developed within the bay and how it changes.
So when you look at pH and you talk 8.25 to 8.15, pH has changed that much. That really isn't the measurement you need to manage around ocean, you know, chemistry. It's very fine, and they're looking at, and I think, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the pressure of CO2 in the water. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that this instrument can measure. It can measure the total alkalinity, which is all the carbonate species, as well as the partial pressure of carbon dioxide. And you use those two numbers, and you can get the aragonite or calcite saturation. And that's the energetic hurdle to laying down shell. And that's what the animal really feels in terms of how energetically costly it is to build their shells. Yep.
So what the catcheries do is they take that information that's collected real time, and they filter the water through shell or some substrate to raise the pH, to increase the aragonite saturation level, and then they can set their larval oysters. Not set, they can spawn their larval oysters. Once they start to grow, and they're less susceptible to really low pH, they can modify the incoming water and allow them to grow until they don't have to modify the water.
So the vulnerabilities in those early phases of development.
Yes. That's when they're most vulnerable, yeah.
And what the scary part is that that's not just oysters, it's everything in the ocean.
And so this goes to a really important point, though, is like when we're talking about oyster culture and aquaculture, they can be very large scale, and they're very susceptible if their source water is compromised. But they can mitigate that, as Greg was saying. They can run their source water through shell or through an algae tank or something to pull the CO2 out and adjust the chemistry. And get their, like you said, get to the point where the oysters, if they have enough food, are able to grow even if it's a challenging environment. That's not the case on the open coast, though. There's evidence in Puget Sound, which actually has a fairly strong ocean acidification, like actually increase in the acidity of the water signal, that there's evidence that like intertidal ecosystems are changing. Fleshy algae are more commonly replacing calcifying algae or calcifying shell organisms because they're outcompeting them.
Fleshy algae.
They're the anything that doesn't, like, if you go to the intertidal and you see those red coralline algae, okay, they may not even look like seaweed. They're like crusty.
Right.
So those are the coralline or crustose algae. The fleshy algae would be like your kelps and your things like that, that don't require.
Thank you. I just had to visualize a fleshy alga.
Fleshy versus crusty.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
But when we think about, you know, open coast exposures, that's where this balance between productivity and pH for the organisms that are there matter. But then also the production of those the larvae of coming out of a mussel bed, how are they going to fare? And are they going to survive enough to come back and replenish that mussel bed? It really is kind of, there's two ends of the thing that we can fix by plumbing and the thing that we have to fix by basically global atmospheric...
lifestyle changes.
Yeah, lifestyle changes.
Right, right. Okay, so if you're just joining us, you're listening to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, and we are talking about climate change and the effects on marine ecosystems. My guests are Greg Dale from Coast Seafoods, Joe Tiberzi from California Sea Grant, and Eric Bjorkstead from the National Marine Fisheries Service. We welcome your calls at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911, or give us a text at 707-492-KHSU. If you want to just hang on and listen, that's fine too. I got a list of questions and a lot of thoughts here. So, all right, we were talking about changes in the chemistry, changes in temperature at the big ocean level, and then we were talking about how that may or may not relate to the bay. What's the level of mixing that happens between the near shore and the bay, and how does that interplay? Do you guys know?
excuse me, as Greg was saying, there's not a lot of freshwater input to the bay, so there's a lot of exchange with the near shore. Freshwater does get into the bay, but most of that freshwater is coming from the Eel River and coming up the coast and gets swept in. That's where a lot of the sediment comes from.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's kind of a reverse estuary in that way. But as far as, you know, how does ocean productivity or ocean water get into the bay? There's a couple things that we do know. Is that, it does. Okay. There are instruments maintained by the Central and Northern California Coastal Ocean Observing System, or CENCOOS, in the bay that measure salinity, temperature, chlorophyll, fluorescence. And there's a master's thesis by Greg O'Connell a couple of years ago where he documented the presence of oceanic phytoplankton coming into the bay and going out. You know, when the tide was out, it was the benthic diatoms sweeping by the instrument. When the tide was coming in, it was oceanic water.
And is that like on storm events in particular?
Well,
or
it's tidal.
Tidal.
It's tidal. It's basically tidally driven. I mean, there's certainly the storm events, whether it's windy and mixing up the bay water, things like that. That'll, you know, and then in the seasonal cycle of upwelling, non-upwelling, big freshwater lens from the Eel River, things like that. We are working slowly but surely, often without funding, to build a circulation model of the bay coupled to a circulation model of the ocean that will actually, you know, take wind forcing, calculate the ecosystem, be parameterized with observations to try to understand how two things. One, productivity, the phytoplankton being produced in the ocean. How is that supplied to the bay? How much of it gets up to the oyster grounds? And then conversely, or the flip side, so that would be the good thing. The flip side would be when we see low pH water upwelling next to the coast, say that we can monitor off the wharf at Trinidad, how much of that gets into the bay? And then, like Joe was mentioning with that project, what's the fate of that water as it comes into the bay?
Right.
So do we know quantitatively? Not yet. We're working on it.
Yeah.
And the one of the goals of that project is to identify, so it appears based on existing CENCOOS.
CENCOOS is a particular observational system.
CENCOOS is that system that that Eric mentioned, the Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System.
Okay.
CENCOOS.com. And everybody could access all that water quality data every day. CENCOOS. CENCOOS.
Okay.
And is it .com? It might be .org.
It is .org. Yeah.
Yeah.
My apologies.
But if you just Google CENCOOS, you'll get it.
Yeah.
So if you want to get deep into the statistics, or is it pretty...
It's user-friendly, and you can play around and graph different. You can graph dissolved oxygen or salinity over the last month or
years.
Weeks.
You can go back. You can actually go back a long ways.
That's pretty amazing.
But it's really a neat resource.
Well, before Joe goes on, I think Eric's on the board, and he spends a great deal of time making sure that time and money and effort and travel, making sure that we have that water quality data.
And I would imagine not everybody has that kind of data.
We're getting more and more around the country.
I mean, are we in a data deficit here, or are we data rich?
It's all relative. Yeah. The fact that the bay is instrumented and that we have a coastal observation point at the Trinidad Wharf, and even we have, from my program, we actually have offshore measurements. We're in good shape. We don't have a full-time mooring, really like that. Compared to Monterey Bay, we're not very well instrumented. Mm-hmm. Compared to large stretches of the West Coast, we're in pretty good shape.
Right.
As Eric said, we have a lot right here where we are, where Humboldt State is, but we're not like Monterey Bay, where there are like seven institutions within a 50-mile radius, all of which have their own separate, you know, systems that they contribute. So
Okay, all right.
We're still pretty fortunate.
Yeah.
Back to you, Joe.
I was just going to say that, so the Senkus instruments at Trinidad, which is open coast, versus those inside Humboldt Bay, we know that Humboldt Bay water is, to some degree, buffered. So when we see strong upwelling that results in a really rapid drop in pH on the open coast, we don't see pH getting as low inside the bay. So something is preventing, buffering the water, preventing the pH from getting as low. And it's not, there are a few possible mechanisms that could be behind that. And so that's one of the objectives of this new research is going to be to document how much of that may be from eelgrass and how much of it may be from a couple other possible mechanisms of buffering.
Right. Let's shift a little bit and talk about what's going on with the fisheries. And there's been a lot of news in the paper that ocean conditions aren't very good. But what's the bigger outlook for our fisheries? And I'm looking at you, Eric. But anyone is welcome to...
Tell us it ain't so, Eric.
Well, given that I have not caught many fish off my boat, I'm pretty sad to say. It's not looking good, at least in the near future. We've all seen that the salmon fishery north of Horse Mountain is closed to protect the Klamath Run, which is in pretty bad shape. And it's in bad shape because, the combined effects of the drought, limiting access to the spawning grounds, and the effects of the warm blob on the marine ecosystem. Well, the warm blob and then the subsequent El Nino on the marine ecosystem that juvenile salmon depend on as they make that transition from freshwater to the marine environment.
So there wasn't a lot of food when they went out.
No, in 2014, the blob water really didn't impinge upon the coast until September. Now, Klamath River salmon are going out, they start going out in May, June, July, August. They're going out all summer. And we didn't really see that sharp spike in temperature until September when upwelling kind of stopped and the warm water slammed into the coast. But from our observations, this ship transect that we were on off Trinidad Head, we were beginning to see the effects of this climate. And when I say climate, I don't mean climate change. I mean just large-scale atmospheric structure and process, climate, the integrated weather, if you will. We were beginning to see the effects of that warming pattern in the plankton starting late spring of 2014. They were beginning to see a shift in the community composition of copepods, which are really small crustaceans. They're very diverse. There are a lot of species of them. And they're the base of they dominate the animal base of the food chain, that transfer, eat all the phytoplankton and push it on up the food chain. We began to see a shift from the cold water, lipid-rich, nice fatty copepods that we would normally see in upwelling to these small, lipid-poor species that are more common in southern waters and in warm waters. We began to see that shift, and then that shift got really dramatic in 2014, 2015. It's a good indicator. And the other thing that happened is the krill, the little kind of, they look like shrimp, but they're things that whales eat. We saw a shift in that community as well. Not only were we getting different species, but the ones that were here that dominate the community were getting smaller. So they were less high-quality food for baby salmon. And so we just basically saw low productivity. Those fish were going out into an ocean that wasn't providing what they needed to really thrive. Here we are 3 years later, and survivorship was low. There aren't enough salmon coming back. We have to keep the fishery pressure off them so that those that do come back can begin to rebuild the population.
And I'll add to that, Eric, that oysters kind of followed the same, they got smaller, they were skinnier, they didn't grow as fast over the same period, all based on the same exact issue. Huh.
But I will go, when we think about the future, though, and hope, because we do want to always keep hope in mind. In 2005, we had the same thing happen.
Okay.
We had the coastwide salmon fishery closure because upwelling didn't, it was supposed to start somewhere in March or April, and it didn't start till June. you know, along the coast. And so there was this huge area along the California coast that was basically clear water. There was no productivity. I was out on the ocean at the time. We put down big nets, and they would come up empty in these trawl surveys. And so we had a closure there. And 3-4 years later, 5 years later, something like that, all you had to do was take your boat out and tip it a little sideways, and the fish jumped in. You know, it was kind of the salmon have the capacity to rebound.
Right.
Typically have the capacity to rebound quite strongly once conditions get back into their favorable space. So, you know, knock on wood, we'll see amelioration of the drought. We'll see a resumption of some level of ocean productivity, and we'll be okay. But, you know, if it continues, it could be bleak. You know, I mean, that's what caused the large scale declines in salmon in the 90s that led to listings and things like that. It was an unfavorable ocean for a long time.
And is the ocean temperature back to normal? Is the blob gone?
No, actually. It's still warmer than typical. Mm-hmm. We're coming out of a... we had the blob come, and then that kind of didn't really go away. We had a really strong El Nino, tropical El Nino, that actually had a fairly significant effect up along the coast. And there's some evidence that the kind of blobs sort of reconstituted, sort of didn't. There's still a lot of heat trapped in the ocean out there. And we're actually forecast to go back into mild El Nino conditions in the next 6 months or so. It's a forecast. We'll see how it plays out. But no, we're in kind of a warm phase. I mean, the ocean goes through these phases, captured by, you guys may have, will have known, of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation.
Right.
And these large-scale modes of variability. And, you know, in the 90s, we were in a warm phase. And then we went into the 2000s, and it was kind of a fluctuating but cooler phase. And we're not sure if we've gone back into a warm phase that's going to persist or not. But certainly the last 2 years has been a warm phase. And we'll see how it goes. It doesn't look like it's gotten a whole lot cooler yet, but I haven't looked at our latest cruise data. I can't tell you for sure.
Right. Okay.
Well, isn't the water still fairly warm off the coast of BC and Washington still?
Yeah.
I mean, there's still a fairly big blob there.
Yeah. If you look at I'm waving my hands on radio because that's really good.
Yeah.
If you look at a map of, you know, sea surface temperature anomalies, is the water warmer or cooler than it should be for a given location? It's still warm along the coast in a typical, what we call a positive Pacific decadal oscillation pattern, where the California current is warmer than it should be, or warmer than it is on average.
Okay.
I don't want to add value to that.
Right. So, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic. We're talking about climate change and the effect on marine ecosystems. We've got about 15 minutes or so left on the show. And, you know, we've got a couple more, I think, important questions. I want to make sure we get to kind of how can the interested public get involved in this conversation? And, you know, maybe how we can learn more about what we produce here. And within that vein, I think we should talk a little bit about kind of the Coast Seafoods expansion plan, since it's been in the news quite a bit. And I think there's some confusion about what's out there. And maybe you could just say a little bit about how people can learn more or...
Well, the project's been going on for quite a while. And the goal is to grow more oysters and have less impact. And so what we do know about shellfish interactions in the environment is if you spread things out, you have less impact, both to, you know, recreational users, to species that utilize the bay and eelgrass. So the goal is to change our current footprint, expand out, and change, well, honestly, bring it up to date with some more modern culture techniques that grow better oysters a little bit faster, a little bit cleaner, a little bit easier on both the environment and the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the goal here.
Right.
And to do it without
so impacting. To modernize, reduce impacts, spread out the production so that eelgrass can flourish within the production lines.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing there's probably some more mandated monitoring and kind of adaptive learning that's...
Oh, yeah. No, there's a lot of monitoring. In fact, that's part of the process that's taken so long is the just designing the monitoring. And Joe participated in this a lot in the beginning. To just the statistics involved with monitoring is very complex.
Yeah.
Because of the variability in the bay.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's all moving forward, and mm-hmm. It's slow, mm-hmm. but I think the process is pretty well vetted, and there's a lot of input.
Yeah. Well, in prep for the show today, I would say I went onto the Harbor Commission website and found the EIR there and was impressed how much you could read. And
700 pages of easy reading.
Easy reading, but I mean, there is kind of an executive summary there, and there's an opportunity to get a sense of what the issues are and, the importance of eelgrass and, how these new modern techniques have co-location and the capacity, I think, for both organisms to co-locate and a feedback mechanism to make sure that things aren't getting out of whack.
Yeah.
So I was impressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been fun. That process is always fun. What's really interesting is the bay is pretty dynamic. The ocean is dynamic. The bay is
okay.
The bay is also, things change in the bay all the time.
And yeah.
What's interesting is, we had this big HAB scare with domoic acid 3 or 4 years ago, and it was offshore. And Senkus is made up of a lot of really smart scientists. And there's a woman there named Clarissa Anderson, mm-hmm. and she developed this model to predict where we were going to start seeing HAB problems, domoic acid or pseudonychia is the species she was looking at. And she had these predictions that we were going to see these large blooms of domoic acid offshore. And we weren't seeing them. Because we monitor weekly from in the bay for shellfish, and we weren't seeing these numbers. And then all of a sudden, Eric and the folks offshore were doing these cruises, were starting to pick up these higher numbers, and the model was proving true. And there's a disconnect between what happens in the ocean and what happens in the bay. And that's still, I don't think, well described. I don't know why we have that disconnect.
Yeah, we don't know. That's when we're talking about that whole ocean bay exchange question. How much does when you get into the near shore, oceanography gets really squirrely about what the where boundaries kind of set up, and it's weird. Water can resist mixing, if you will, under certain circumstances. But that goes actually. I wanted to, if I can, with how do people get involved,
mm-hmm.
things like that. When we were seeing that harmful algal bloom unfolding along the coast, and we're seeing the effects of the warm blob on marine ecosystems, one element of what we call citizen science that really helped quantify that was the folks that walk the beach and identify, monitor, and tag seabird carcasses.
Right.
And, folks sign up for this program, and I wish I could remember what the name of it is,
Coast.
But it's a coast. It's another coast with an extra S in it.
Coast with two S's.
Coast with two S's. Julia Parrish runs it. And they walk the beach, and they count birds, and we're actually able to quantify the impacts on the ecosystem through seabirds, a high trophic level response.
That is a really cool program. I mean, I'm quite fascinated that, through mortality you can find some great information. I believe we do have a caller. Is that correct, Michael?
Yes, we do. We have an off-air caller and then one on-air. So I'll do the off-air question first.
Okay.
It's quick. So there's actually two. One is from Mary. She just wanted to thank everybody for their work they're doing, especially during a political climate like this. And also, there was another one who just wanted to get what the blob was quickly redefined.
Okay.
The blob was a huge expanse of the North Pacific that was basically a lot warmer than it should have been. There's a lot of good information on this online, so I'd rather than burn up our time, mm-hmm. say go look it up. But it was basically 3.5 million square miles of water at the surface that was 3 to 4 degrees centigrade warmer than it should have been, and it propagated across the west coast, across the North Pacific, and ran into our coasts and had some pretty profound ecosystem impacts.
It was associated with this ridiculously resilient high pressure ridge.
Yep,
that helped
all tied in with the drought.
Right,
create
right. Drought. So if you Google the blob, you'll see some images of how big it was and all
1950s cinematography.
We also have a caller. I think we have Kelly from Mad River. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. I'm sorry, I'm not able to hear you right now.
How are you? Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. Can you speak up?
I'm sorry, I'm not able to hear you right now. Can you hear me now?
That's a little better. I think we've got some feedback there. Maybe you could give a call back?
I can take his question. He wanted to know about farming red abalone in the Trinidad area.
So farming red abalone in the Trinidad area, is that something we can do? Technically, is it something...
I can say that the Trinidad area gets some pretty significant low pH exposures during the upwelling season. So I can't say as to whether that would be bad for red abalone. I mean, it would be bad for small red abalone.
Well, I think you could certainly grow them. Yeah. There's a lot of energy right there. It's a fairly open expanse of shoreline, so it's going to be tough to keep anything anchored out there. Mm-hmm. There was a gentleman that grew them in Crescent City, in the harbor of Crescent City, did quite well with them until he had a big dissolved oxygen issue, and it killed his whole farm in one day. But the problem with red abalone or with any abalone growth in this section of the coast is we just don't have a whole lot of kelp. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much the diet that you have to feed them is kelp.
Is that why Mendocino is so much more suited for abalone?
There's more abalone certainly there than there is here. We still have abalone and we still have kelp. It's just you have to feed, you have to harvest and feed a lot of kelp to feed abalone. And so you get down in Southern California, the Santa Barbara, Monterey area, they have kelp beds that they can actually harvest. And kelp's actually a really good species for that type of harvesting and feed. This time, you know, we haven't had kelp's kind of on the rocks right now, I think, up and down the coast.
Or off the rocks.
All right, fair enough. So let's bring it back to this COAST program. Joe, you know quite a bit about it. It's through the Cal Academy of Sciences, is that correct?
The COAST program is through University of Washington
and
Julia Parrish. Mm-hmm. And they train folks, I think generally, I don't remember exactly when they do trainings. They generally do trainings one time a year, but they have a pretty dedicated crew of people, and they get an ID book and information on how to identify carcasses and report them.
And so that gives us a sense of productivity of, do they weigh them? Is it just...
I don't think they weigh them.
No, they're able to identify them by species, identify them by age of decay. They can tell how long it is, and they can statistically forecast a deposition rate.
Right.
That gives you a sense of what the mortality is offering.
But for other people that, you know, there's lots of people that are really interested in what's going on in marine ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to get more involved? What is the Cal Academy of Sciences program?
There's a Cal Academy of Sciences program called Snapshot Cal Coast. They're working to be kind of an every summer project. We're going to, there'll be some folks participating in it. Some of the Marine Protected Area collaborative co-chairs, including me, as well as Delia Benz-Kang with the North Coast Environmental Center and Surf Rider, and Beth Chatton with the Humboldt County Department of Education. We're going to do some days where you go out and work with people who are quite experienced and know a bunch of species, but they use this neat program called iNaturalist, and you use your smartphone and take snap pictures of a bunch of different species, and then if you know how to identify them, you can. But otherwise, you just can post it, and it's geotagged, and then it contributes to this public database of species occurrences, and so it can be a really neat way to look for range expansions Like, for instance, during these warm temperature years, people were seeing the Hopkins rose, which is this funny little pink nudibranch with with little tassels. We're short on time.
We're short on time, yes. Well, I need to wrap it up here. You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk, and I want to thank my guests, Greg Dale from Coast Seafoods, Joe Tiberzi from California Sea Grant, Eric Bjorkstead from National Marine Fisheries Service. I want to thank Kelly and a couple of our off-air callers, and all the thanks for all the folks who've been listening. It's been really fun. It's great to have this dialogue, and I guess what I'm really grateful is that we have such a talented and engaged group of folks involved in these really complicated issues, and it's nice to know that people are dedicated their passion to it. And I'm thrilled that we have such high-quality oysters. So if you get a chance, go visit one of those tours of the bay, and maybe we'll see you at Oyster